Lorna Doone, a radio dramatization in 5 parts by Brian Gere, based on the novel by R.D. Blackmore, with Cornelius Garrett as John Ridd and Stacey Dorning as Lorna Doone. The story is told by Jack Watson. Lorna Doone, Part 4.
Rose diamonds, 25 large brilliants that cannot be matched in London. Would you say it was worth £100,000?
Oh, my Lord. Give me the necklace, Mr. Faggus.
I thought as much, John, lad. The young lady appreciates its worth after all, will not let it go.
It should be lodged in your bosom, John, where it began its journey out of Doone Valley. For there could no safer place be found than next to your true heart. Here, take it. It is my wish.
Yeah, just before it vanishes into that impregnable fortress, may I have another look at it? Yes, it's as I thought. Very old, but of beautiful workmanship. Every line cut true, every angle in its place. You realize, of course, that with treasure like that vanished from their midst, the Doones will come looking for it. And they'll know where to come first.
The next day, Tom Faggus had left us on some pressing business, and scarcely was he clean out of sight than Master Jeremy Stickles came in, splashed with mud from head to foot, and not in the very best of humours.
Curse those fellows.
The Doones, Martha.
Three of them galloping after me all the way from Lanarkar Bridge.
Master Stickles, there is something you must know. We have one of the Doones with us here in the house.
What? What, are you all turned traitor?
Nay, Master Jeremy, you've not heard all. A beautiful young girl. Her name is Lorna. They were trying to force her to marry Carver Doone, but I rescued her and brought her here. She also has with her a necklace which we are told is of great value.
You mentioned that name before. Lorna. I suspected then, and know for certain now. So that's the reason you would have nothing to do with my plan to attack the Doones and flush them out of their burrow. She's your sweetheart, am I not right?
You are indeed. And when you meet her, you'll have no need for second thoughts to know why. But on one point be certain, Master Stickles. She is as clear and pure from all crime as the rest of her clan are black and tainted. For that I give my word. Now tell me, have you brought back your army?
Nah, lass, no. Yes, all I have to show for my trouble is some of the trained bands, but, well, now their discipline is quite gone. Yeah, I'd rather have one trooper than a score from the trained bands. And they I shall get only when the roads are passable.
It seems to me that we may at any time expect an attack upon the farm by the Doones. The more so now that they know you've returned here.
Yes, well, I've a few mounted troopers at Lynmouth. John, could you get through the floods and fetch them?
I could try, by the higher road.
Good man. Now, I'll write you out an authority while you're making ready.
It was no easy task, with months of snow turning to frenzied waters, and all I could show for it was 7 men. And when I returned home, I found the house in a great commotion, and all the women trembling. Lorna herself was the most possessed.
It was all my fault, John. I'd gone to take a turn in the garden at dusk, and all of a sudden I saw 2 eyes staring at me from the elder bush across the stream.
Carver Doone!
Yes. He stood up, and I saw he had a gun. Then he lifted it and pointed it at my heart.
Oh, Lorna! My dear, darling Lorna!
John, you see I am here and alive before you. Now, let me go on with my tale. I was terrified. I could not move, not even to save my life. And then he slowly lowered the gun and fired so that the dirt in front of me was thrown up all over me.
What vile, despicable bullying! The very last refinement of it! Oh, wait till I get my hands on that man!
John, my love, he spoke. He said that unless I come back tomorrow with all I took away, which must mean the necklace, and tell him how he can destroy the fool that took me, which must mean you, John, unless I can do that, my death is in the barrel of his gun where it has long been waiting.
Jeremy, did you hear that?
Aye, I did. And I think we should be prepared for them to attack tonight.
Oh, my Lord.
Carver's words could easily be a trap to lull us into thinking they will do nothing until tomorrow.
And us with less than a dozen to put against the whole of the Doones.
Mrs. Ridd, this is your home. I cannot be so ungrateful as to bring you all into deadly peril for my own sake. Let me go back to the Doones.
No!
You must not pay this great price for my happiness.
My dear child, we're paying no price at all. We're not threatened for your sake only.
There's no guarantee that even if you did return to the Doones, they'd leave us here in peace. That's not their idea of honor.
Well, there is another idea which may cheer you. I believe that Glendune is flooded and all the houses underwater.
Ah.
It happened so once before in heavy rain. And you said, did you not, that there had never been floods so high as these after the snow.
What a brain you have. Why didn't I think of that? Of course. You may rest assured the valley is 6 feet underwater.
Then they cannot send many men against us with all that trouble upon them. That's why there were only 3 to try and cut me off. Come along, John. We must make preparations.
Aye.
We sent all the women to bed early, except Gwenny Carfax, who insisted she be posted as lookout in a tree with a view towards the Doon Valley. Now, it was my greatest desire to come across that vile Carver Doon that night and settle the score between us by a conflict, man to man. Before I had been long on duty, making the round of the ricks and stables, a short, wide figure stole towards me in and out of the shadows. It was Gwenny, to tell me she'd seen no less than 10 Doons creeping along by the hedgerow. She offered to shoot a few of them herself, if I would only lend her my gun. But I sent her to the house to fetch Master Stickles and all the men, while I stayed and watched the ricks. For after our womenfolk, they were my greatest fear. Scarcely had she gone than the Doons walked boldly into the yard. Carver's voice was harsh and clear.
A couple of you make us a light to cut their throats by. And remember, if any man touches Lorna, I'll kill him where he stands. There are a couple of other young girls you may take if you like. And I'm told the mother's still worth a second glance. Now, for our rights. Kill every man and child and burn the cursed place down.
I could see him clearly. My gun was pointing at his breast. And yet, I could not do it. For I had never taken human life before. 2 young men came towards me bearing burning torches. As the first of them set fire to the rick, I struck him backhanded on the elbow, and I heard the bone break. The other stood amazed till I caught his torch and stuffed it in his face, then snapped his collarbone and laid him on top of his comrade. At the same time, our men had let fly at the Doons, 2 of whom fell, and the rest hung back, for they were not used to this sort of thing. Then I went across the yard, expecting every moment to be shot, and seized Carver by his beard.
Take warning, Carver Doon. You've shown yourself a fool by your contempt of me. I may not be your match in cunning, but I am in manhood. You despicable villain. Lie low in your native muck!
Captain Doon! Run for his life!
You shall die for this, degenerate! You shall die in the most horrible way I can devise. You country lout. You ignorant peasant.
By and by. In the meantime, get out of our lands.
Oh, and you're welcome to it. John, lad. John, are you hurt?
No. Nothing but a scratch.
Look at him, Ron. And those 2 dead over there.
Shouldn't we pursue them? Try and capture more of them.
Oh, nay, lad. Not good tactics. All the advantage would be on their side, with only the moon to guide us. And suppose there's another band of them just waiting for us to do that very thing, and then fall on the house, all unprotected. Oh, be content with 2 dead and 2 prisoners. 4 dead, really. For they'll be strung up at the next assize. A good night's work, my boy.
The next day, the prisoners were marched off under escort, and we ourselves were reinforced so strongly from the garrisons along the coast that we had no fear of another attack from the Doons. A few days later, I came in from the fields to find Mother and Lorna entertaining a visitor.
Ah, I can hardly be wrong in assuming that this young man is your son John, sir. I join him, Sir Counselor of Doon.
Oh.
And, as I was about to tell your good mother, I may now be regarded as Mistress Lorna's legal guardian, and as such, I give my full and ready consent to her marriage with your son, madam.
Well, how good of you, sir. How kind.
I always did say that the learnedest people were almost always the best and kindest and the most simple-hearted.
Madam, that is a great sentiment. What a goodly couple they will be. But what is my niece Lorna doing that she does not thank me for my concession to her youthful fancies?
For what am I to thank you, Uncle?
My dear niece, I've told you, for removing the heaviest obstacle between your dutiful self and the object of your affections. I think, indeed, it merits a kiss. It is quite a privilege.
Perhaps it is to you, sir. But I fear that you have smoked tobacco, so it would be less so to me.
Oh,
you are right, child. How keen your sense is. Nevertheless, my consent I give.
There, now.
And the more meritorious it is, in the light of an existing fact, which to weaker minds might have appeared as something of an impediment.
Huh? What fact do you mean, sir? Is it one that I ought to know?
In my opinion, it is. It forms to my mind so fine a basis for the harmony of the matrimonial state. To be brief, as I always endeavor to be, you two young people will have the rare advantage of commencing married life with a subject of common interest to discuss whenever you weary of, well, let us say, of one another.
I do not understand you, sir. Why can you not say what you mean at once?
My dear child, if you must have strong realities, here they are. Your father slew dear John's father, and dear John's father slew yours.
What? I see your plan, Sir Counselor. But it makes no difference. You think by telling this pack of lies to break the love between Lorna and me? But you shall never do that, I tell you. No, not even if your story were true.
You scoundrel! To tell me to my face that I'm a liar? Lorna Doone, stand forth from contact with that heir of parricide, and state in your own mellifluous voice whether you regard this slaughter as a pleasant trifle.
I believe you no more than John does. And even if it were proved to me, if John will take me, then I am his forever.
I appeal to you, Mrs. Ridd, a woman of the soundest good sense. Speak to your son. Young people of the present age have no right feeling of any sort upon the simplest matter.
Speak to my son, I will. To tell him I stand behind every word he says. You old villain! What's the good of the quality if they know only how to make deadly mischief? My sweet love, my darling Lorna, not a word of it is true, and even if it were, you should have our John all the more for it.
Oh, well, let it pass. I meant to come down upon you tonight, but you have turned the tables on me. Taking you on the whole, you know, you are wonderfully good people. And instead of giving me up to the soldiers, as you might have done, here you are, doing your best to make me drunk.
What? Not at all, sir. Here, let me mix you another glass. We rarely have a great gentleman by the side of our embers and oven.
Oh, what with the comfort of this parlor and the choice of tobacco and cordials. It is a long time since I enjoyed an evening so much. God bless me if I know when.
Your worship makes me more proud than I well know what to do with. Nothing gives us greater satisfaction than to please a visitor.
And then, oh, John Ribb, that you have pleased me so well. Oh, that I do not think my legs are entirely fit to carry me to my own bed this night. Perhaps I might impose upon your hospitality still further.
Why, certainly, your worship.
Perhaps I was ever a fool, but the obligations of hospitality are seriously regarded by us country folk. And not until later did I see that the wicked old man was twisting and turning us to his own ends the whole time. His full villainy was not revealed until the next morning, when something occurred to which I was not witness, but of which Annie gave me a good account afterwards. After breakfast, the counselor followed our Annie into the dairy to see how we managed the clotted cream.
Your Honor must plainly understand that the pans are brought in here to cool, after being set in the basin holes with the wood ash under them, which I showed you in the back kitchen.
Have you ever heard that if you pass a string of beads or polished glass over the cream, It will set three times as solid and in thrice the quantity.
No, sir. I've never heard that. But it'd be very easy to try. I'll get my coral necklace. It'll not be witchcraft, will it, sir?
Oh, no, certainly not. But coral will not do, my child. Neither will anything colored. The beads must be of plain, common glass. But the brighter they are, the better.
Then I know the very thing. Lorna has a necklace of some old glass beads. I'm sure she'll lend it to us.
Excellent. But remember one thing, Annie. You must not say what it is for, or even that I am going to use it, or the spell will be broken.
I thought you said it was not witchcraft.
Of course it isn't, child. Charm, if you prefer it. Charm or spell, it's all the same. Do you know where she keeps this worthless trinket?
Be sure I do. Cannot hurt it, can we, by passing it over the cream pan?
Hurt it? Nay, we shall do it good. Now do run along and fetch it, or it'll be too late to be of use.
This very minute, sir. Here it is. Will it do, do you think?
Oh, that old thing. Yes, I remember it well. Yes, it will do for want of a better. Now then. Three times three, I pass it over. Crinklum, crankum, grass, and clue! What are you feared of, you silly child?
Yes, there it is, perfect witchcraft. Oh, what would Mother say to me? Should I ever go to heaven again? Oh, I see the cream already.
To be sure you do. But you must not look, or the charm will be broken, and the devil will fly away with the pan and drown every cow you possess in it.
Oh, sir, it's too horrible. How can you lead me to such sin?
Nonsense, it is no sin at all. Now, not a word of this to a living soul. Go to your room, bolt yourself in, and read the Lord's Prayer backwards for 3 hours. By that time, the pan will be cream to the bottom. I shall put the beads under this pannikin, which no one must lift for a day and a night.
And of course, when poor Annie went to lift the pannikin, Lorna's necklace had gone. And by that time, so had Counselor Doone. A wretched time Annie had of it, confessing what had happened, and it put me into a terrible passion.
Not just the value. You know I loved you long before I knew a bat. No. It's the thought of your sorrow at losing something of your mother's. And about that old cheat and swindler led us all astray with his smooth words, abusing our hospitality and taking advantage of a simple, honest girl. Oh, if he were only a young man, I'd know how to serve him.
And I took myself out into the good fresh air to try if that would bring some peace to my mind. I went a long way that day, and in paths I did not usually take. And so it happened that I found myself on the edge of the sea by Watchet Town, and there, snuggling into a hollow, was a little inn that looked too inviting to be passed by.
Is there a quart of ale to be had, good woman?
Of course there is. Come in, young man. Come in and sit down. A moment, and I will draw it for you.
You're not from these parts, mistress, by your way of speaking. And yet you seem to be well settled here.
Of course I am well settled. I am married to a good and honest man who makes the blue watchet wear. I keep this little inn. Why should I not be settled? Here is your beer. It is beer all the time with you Englishmen.
And what nationality are you yourself, if I might ask?
I come from Italy. Ah, the blue skies. I shall never see them again. But I am content. After what I've lived through, this quiet life is very agreeable to me. Why do you look at me so closely, young man?
I have the feeling that you and I have met before.
Oh, no. I do not think that can be.
Now I have it! The pump! The maid at the pump in Dulverton.
What are you talking of? What pump? What maid?
Do you not remember the pump in the yard of the Black Horse in Dulverton? And the little boy who worked the handle for you. And the...
the nebule that had to be formed in the glass before it would do.
Oh, yes, now I remember too. But are you that little boy? Oh, he was so beautiful, his little white chest and his lovely teeth. No, no. A great thing like you could not have grown from such a little fellow.
But I did, and John Ridd is my name.
And Benita is mine. But now I am married, so I am Benita Odom.
Well, Mistress Odom, and I saw you again. Later that same day, but you pretended not to see me.
And where was that?
On the road to Orr. Your carriage was laboring in the mud, for the road was very bad. Yes, and there was a beautiful lady in the carriage with you, and two little children. What became of them? And why are you not with them now?
You ask a lot of questions, John Ridd.
Because our John Fry had come to fetch me home from school. My father had just been killed by the Doones. It was a day I shall not quickly forget. I often wondered what happened to the fine folk in the carriage we passed along the way. I thought you might have fallen foul of the Doones that night, for we saw them later, wending their way home after some foray. There was a little girl hanging across one of their horses, I remember.
A little girl, you say? How was she dressed?
Oh, I can't remember that. It was dark and foggy, and the only light was from Dunkery Beacon, and we were taking some care not to be seen ourselves.
Could it have been? Could it have been Mistress Lorna?
What name did you say?
I was thinking of the daughter of the lady I served. Oh, what a dreadful night that was.
But you said her name was Lorna. The little girl's name was Lorna.
What is that to you?
I must know everything that happened that night. And everything about the people. The lady, I mean. And who her husband was. Everything you know about them.
But what business is it of yours?
Forgive me if I seem inquisitive, Mistress Oldham. But this is of the greatest importance to me. Perhaps I know where the little girl is now.
And you could take me to her?
Perhaps.
You must understand that many years ago, I was working in a large hostelry in Rome. Many travelers from all over the world came to stay there, particularly Catholics, to see St. Peter's and the Holy Father, too, if that was possible. Among these travelers was a rich and noble family from your own land, the Earl and Countess of Dougal. When they were ready to move on, they asked me if I would like to go with them to care for the children. You see, I had looked after them while I was staying there, and a great attachment had grown up between us.
But had they no nurse or governess traveling with them?
Oh, at the start, yes. But she had fallen ill, and they had to leave her with some nuns to nurse her. So I traveled on with them, and gradually found out that their family was divided by some feud which made one half hate the other. But at first on our journey, everything went well. The Earl was a young man and full of life. He would never travel inside the carriage if he could find a good horse and ride on in front. And while we were crossing the mountains into France, his horse slipped or stumbled. We do not know for certain what happened. And threw him into a ravine. My lady was so stricken with grief that she almost refused to believe it had happened. But eventually we pressed on towards England. And months later we landed somewhere, Plymouth was it? And then by coach we traveled to the inn at Dulverton, where I saw you at the pump. My lady had a mansion near Watchet, and it was our intention to go there that night.
And what happened on that part of the journey? Were you attacked by the Doones?
Yes. I think they were Doones. I remember that when they came to the carriage door, my lady recognized one of them. I know that man, she cried. He is our worst enemy. They had attacked us by the edge of the sea and forced our coach into the water until it overturned. I was stunned from a blow on the head. Probably that saved me. The last thing I remember was seeing my lady throw a necklace over the little girl's head and cover her with a traveling cloak. She knew they would rob her, and she was trying to save the child and the most valuable of the jewels at the same instant.
Go on. What happened next?
That I cannot tell you. We had a couple of serving men with us, and I came to my senses to find one of them bathing my forehead with seawater. The little girl had disappeared, and her brother was dead in my lady's arms.
Her reason was gone. And by morning, she too was dead from shock and grief. They buried her and the little boy in Watchet churchyard.
The necklace you mentioned, was it perhaps of very fine diamonds and exceedingly valuable?
Yes, it was. Do you know something of this? You said you might know where the little girl is today. Oh, if she's alive, I would give much to see her again. Such beautiful eyes she had.
Mistress Autumn, you've given me great food for thought. Now, I am slow of brain and must have time to think on what you've told me. For if it is true, then certain great consequences may depend on it. And I must take counsel of others before I act.
Now, two things seem to be clear from what Mistress Odom had told me. One was that the little girl in the coach must be Lorna Doone. And the other was that Lorna was not a Doone at all. And Master Stickles agreed with me when I told him the general drift of this upon my return.
And one thing more, John. Chancery will know of this, you may depend upon it.
Chancery?
Aye, the highest court of the land will want to know about a missing heiress. But
then should we not tell Lorna?
As yet we have no proof. Now, if this Mistress Odom should recognize your Lorna as the young girl she'd been in charge of...
Why, that's easily done.
Ah, not so fast, my young friend. There's other work before that. Did you not see my yellow boys in the yard as you came by? Well, when the red men of Devon join them, which I expected any time, then I shall be ready for my attack upon the Doone Valley. And I ask you again, John, will you join me?
Yes, Master Jeremy, I will now. But supposing we're both shot, is Lorna to remain in ignorance of something that might change her whole life?
Both shot? You and I to be shot? With all this inferior food for powder anxious to be devoured? Well, when one comes to think of it, some provision should be made. Yes, you best write it all down, with instructions on the envelope to be opened in the unfortunate event, etc., etc.
And so I spent that night in setting down all I could remember of Mistress Odom's story. The yellows and the reds that Master Stickles had spoken of were the trained bands of Devon and Somerset, the yellow uniforms being Somerset men and the red those of Devon. 120 all told. Besides these, we had 15 troopers of the regular army, all sleeping in our barns and stacks and eating at our expense. The next day, Colonel Stickles, as everybody now called him, gave the order to march, and we began to try to do it. A good deal of boasting was flung about. The parish choir came part of the way with some of the most pugnacious psalms, and Parson Bowden marched at the head, for we were attacking the Papists after all, and promised to stay with us until we came to bullet distance. And I wondered where Uncle Reuben was, who ought to have led the culverins if Stickles could only have found him.
Now, this is my plan of attack, John Ladd. So listen carefully. The men of Devon shall march on rounds so as to reach the western side and attack with their culverin from the cliffs. And the men of Somerset shall take their culverin and stay on this side on the eastern heights.
What of the third culverin?
That comes with us and the troopers, and we shall assault the main gates.
That is a most brilliant plan of war, Jeremy. I must congratulate you on it.
Thank you, my boy. It's true I deserve high praise. And yet I cannot be sure of success.
How's that?
Well, look around you. What do you see? Highly disciplined army? No. A raw militia. Brave enough, no doubt, but knowing little of gunnery and quite unused to being shot at. No, we shall need our fair share of the luck. And tell me now, could you yourself stand being under fire?
Well, as to that, I think I should dislike it as much as anything.
I dare say you do. Now then, halt, men! Oh, God, halt, I say! Now listen to me. Just around this corner of rock is the main entrance to the Doone Valley. A cavern with a door at the back of it. We may expect to find it defended. So, when we hear the fire from the Devon men and the Somerset men on either side of the valley, which you may be sure will throw the Doones into utter confusion, we shall charge their stronghold here, which will naturally have flown to the aid of their comrades in the valley itself. Now, is that clear?
Yeah!
There they are! The Doones! And see! Oh, see! On, the gate is undefended! Ah. Follow me!
Up there, Jeremy! Over the cave mouth in the brushwood!
Come on, lads! Come on, lads. One dash on, and we're beyond them! Hurrah! Oh. Oh.
Jeremy was down, and so were several of our brave fellows. Then something blotted out the sun for a moment, and there was a fearful crash. The dunes, from their position over the cave mouth, had launched a tree trunk down on us, and our cannon, which had never fired, was under it. And so were two men and a horse. I ran back to Jeremy. The shot had taken him in the mouth, and I could do nothing for him but rest his head and try to stop him bleeding. And then there was a scamper and a rattle of loose pebbles, and there was Tim, the shoemaker's apprentice, by my side.
What are you doing here? Your mother will beat
you. Best to run, John Ridd. We've got the worst of it. I've seen it all.
What have you seen, you imp?
Men of Devon wouldn't wait till they was properly in position. Just aim that cannon any old hour and rip the general direction. And bang, right in the middle of the element.
Fools. And then what?
Men of Zom is that. Instead of waiting for men of Devon to send round and beg their pardon, they just bangs off back. Down goes the men of Devon. Then they just bang each other. Instead of those cursed dunes.
And what do they do? The dunes?
Comes up from behind somewhere and catches the men of Zamazet and kills four of them beside their cannon. Saw it all from my tree, I did. Those that aren't dead are running for their lives. And you'd best be doing the same before the dunes think of looking around here.
Right, boy. But first, give me a hand with Colonel Stickles here. He's wounded and we must get him home.
Yes, sir. Right away.
This was a sad end to our brave setting out, and everybody blamed everybody else. But upon one point, all were agreed that the root of the evil was to be found in the way Parson Bowden went up the hill, with his hat on and no cassock. What was left of the Devonshire men went home, having beans to sow, and our Somerset friends only stayed for 2 days more to backbite them, leaving us with 10 of the troopers who were still alive and Sergeant Bloxham over them. And if ever they should choose to leave, then our goods and our lives would surely be at the mercy of the dunes. Jeremy Stickles tossed and turned and thrust up his feet in agony, but after some weeks he came round gently, though never to be the man he had been, and never to speak loud again. Now, this Sergeant Bloxham I speak of, a worthy man, but a trifle overzealous, sat up the best part of 3 nights writing a report, which he must needs read over to Lizzie, she having told him what a good judge she was of literature.
And then, through some dreadful, rash, and precarious oversight, the men of Devon...
Not precarious, good Sergeant Bloxham. I do not see how an oversight may be precarious.
You think not, Mistress Lizzie. Well, I dare say you're right. Very well, then. Through some dreadful, rash oversight, the men of Devon...
And not rash, neither. An oversight, I think, cannot in good literature be rash. An action indeed may be rash, but hardly an oversight.
Not rash?
No.
Very well. Through some dreadful oversight...
I think, Sergeant Bloxham, we may infer from what follows that the oversight was indeed dreadful.
Not dreadful?
No, Sergeant Bloxham. An oversight is dreadful enough without your saying so.
Is that your considered opinion, Mistress Lizzie?
Oh, indeed. You overload your gun, Sergeant Bloxham.
Oh, Mistress Lizzie, surely not.
And the end of that was that Sergeant Bloxham, hearing his finished report pronounced so elegant, so chaste, and so fervent, fell in love with our Lizzie on the spot. You will recall that Master Stickles, before our unfortunate assault upon the dunes, had mentioned that the Court of Chancery would have heard of Lorna's case. And so it turned out. A man appeared at our gate one day, stripped to his shirt, with no horse, and looking very sorrowful.
Is there a young lady residing here by the name of Lorna Doone?
Who wants to know?
His Majesty's Court of Chancery. And I trust you will give me a kinder welcome than the villains I have just left.
I suppose you must speak of the dunes.
I do. They asked me to serve my writ, and when I did so, advised me to serve it here, sending me on my way with a good beating and removing my horse and the best part of my apparel to make my journey the easier.
You shall not be so treated here, good sir. And your writ concerns Lorna Doone?
Two writs, to be precise. One advising any who have custody of Lorna Doone to render her to the accredited officers of the court upon pain of heavy fine.
What?
And the other calling upon the said Mistress Doone to hold herself in readiness to travel and commit herself to no one except the aforesaid accredited officers.
But...
Here, read for yourself. I suppose you can read.
More trouble upon us. Mother and I held great consultation over both these documents with a mixture of wrath and fear. And so I took it upon myself, not being able to consult with Jeremy Stickles, to tell my mother all that I knew, or thought I knew, concerning Lorna's parentage, and then Lorna herself. While we were full of all these things, another very important matter called for our attention.
No more fast and loose, Mrs. Ridd. Either one thing or the other. I love Annie, and she loves me. And we'll have one another either with your leave or without it.
You have some ground for complaint, Tom. I won't deny it. Now, I'll be straightforward with you. John and myself have all along disliked your marriage with Annie.
But
not for what you have been, so much as what we fear you will be.
But have I not
now,
turned over
a... patience one moment, if you please. We don't fear your taking to the highway life again. For that, you're too clever. And besides, now you have property. But we do fear you'll take to drinking and squandering money. Now, it's been hard to tell you this under our own roof, and with our own spirits on the table before you. As you know, Tom, you're welcome to every drop.
I know, good mother. And to prove it, I will have some more.
Yes, and take a little more. You've mixed it over a week.
Oh, thank you, John, I will. If ever there was a sober man, a man of perfect sobriety, that man is before you now.
Oh.
Shall we say tomorrow week, mother? It will suit your washing day.
How very thoughtful of you, Tom. Now, you see, John would never have thought of that, in spite of all his steadiness.
And so it was arranged. And, of course, there were wedding presents to buy in Dulverton. But to my mother, the most important matter seemed to ensure Uncle Reuben's attendance. So off I went with more commissions than a man with thrice my memory might safely carry. But when I saw Uncle Ben... what a shock was in store. From a hale and rather heavy man, plump and ruddy, he was altered to a shrunken, trembling, almost decrepit figure.
Come to Annie's wedding? Certainly not. I'm far too busy. Far too involved in deep doings to dance attendance upon your Annie's wedding. You must make my excuses.
She'll be most disappointed, Uncle. And so will Mother.
Oh, they'll get over it. Women lay far too much store by such nonsense.
But you'll let Ruth come.
Ruth? I want Ruth in the shop. I'm not here much myself these days. And Cousin Ruth, you're very pat with my granddaughter's name, young man.
Be hard upon me, sir, not to know my own cousin's name.
You've behaved very badly to Ruth.
I have? But how?
She loves you, and you do not love her, that's how. And now you have the impudence to rub salt in the wound by asking her to watch Annie being wed to some rogue eye woman. A fine way the young behave, to be sure.
But, sir, I know not. I mean,
you may well be ashamed, young man. You're the biggest of all fools, a conceited coxcomb. Oh, but I can't waste time on that. Since you're here, I am resolved to tell you my secret. Oh, it wears me out to dwell upon it all alone, for I can't tell it to Ruth. Besides... you're just the man I want to help me. I'm engaged in a little enterprise.
And I will help you, sir. That is, in anything not contrary to the laws of the realm.
You went the same fool's track as all the rest. The same as Spy Stickles and all his precious troopers. Landing of arms at Lynmouth, disaffection at Taunton, insurrection at Dunster, sounds of wagons and metal and booming noises. Oh, we managed it right well. Not even you suspected. Now, who do you suppose is at the bottom of all this Exmoor insurgency? Who's at the bottom of it, eh?
Either Mother Meldrum or old Nick himself.
Nay, old Uncle Reuben.
Well, then... Captain Stickles was right in calling you a rebel, sir.
Of course he was. Could so keen a man be wrong about an old fool like me? Come and see your rebellion, John. Only give me your word to keep silence.
Very well. But where am I to come?
Come alone, and at 10 tomorrow morning, meet me at the Wizard's Marsh. You great fool, are you frightened? I want a young man of steadfast courage as well as of strength and silence.
I'm brave enough, sir, whenever I see my enemy, but not where witch and wizard be.
Ah, the only witch or wizard here is the one that bewitches all men.
Who might that be?
You shall see soon enough. Now, fasten up our horses, and not too near the marsh. Two good men and their mounts have gone mining on their own account just here.
You mean killed? Lost in the bog?
Well, that's what I said, did I not?
You speak of it so cool.
Well, it's not I that asked them to come prying after me. They must look to it themselves.
And mining. You mentioned mining.
I did. That's what I've asked you here to see. Are you man enough for it?
Oh, man enough for anything you are, Uncle.
Then follow in my steps exactly. Unless you want to go where the other two went. Here we are. This is the entrance to the mine.
What? This filthy hole in the ground?
It serves its purpose. Some rogue came spying here, just as one of our men came out of it. Spy was frightened out of his life and never ventured to come again. We put the blame of that upon you. But I say that we were wrong.
Altogether wrong. Do you think I'm mean enough to spy upon anyone dwelling with us and partaking of our hospitality?
Well, we'll say no more of it. Now, John, will you come and meet the wizard, or does your courage fail you?
How do we go down? I see no steps or ladder.
No, John. You don't. Too easy for spies. That would be. Just step into this bucket. This is our Jacob's ladder, boy.
All right. Over. I'm not afraid I'd have you know, Uncle Ben, but I do love air and heaven.
What a one you are for complaining, John Red. Let go below!
We ever get up to air and light again? And what will poor mother do without me, her only son?
What a young man you are for what I mean. Well, get out of the bucket now. Oh!
It is so dark, I can't see!
We have torches. You'll soon get used to it. Carfax, did you ever see a bigger coward come down the shaft?
I think they ought to like first time as it does it.
Hail to the world of gold, John Red.
Gold? Gold, did you say?
Aye, gold. The wizard that bewitches all men. For this is my gold mine.
It is very dirty, Uncle Ben.
Did you expect to see the roof of gold and the sides of gold and the floor of gold?
I reckon her did, no doubt it did.
Come on, then, my lad, and we'll show you something better than dirt and darkness. We want your great arm on something that's beaten a lot of us. Follow me and keep close behind. This great boulder here, this is what I want you for. We tried it in for a fortnight, and he's enough worth cracking. Will he do it for us?
Hold my coat and waistcoat, then, fellow.
There be no man outside Colonel that can crack that boulder.
Sledgehammer? Thank you. Now, stand well clear. Hammer's too small. Have you done bigger?
There's this one. Oh, there's no man in the mine who can swing it.
Give it. Never mind. If I crack this rock for you, I must have some of the gold that's inside it.
You fool. Do you think to see the gold come tumbling out like the curl in the nut?
Well then, I say I must do it if I saved you from the Jones, for kinship's sake. Stand back, all!
Will you find a man in Cornwall can do the like of that?
More. However, it'd be pretty fair for a lad of these outlandish parts. Get your orders, lads, and lead it to the crushing entrance.
You've done us a good turn, my boy. And now, I'll
show you the bottom of a very wondrous mystery. But we must not do it more than once, for it's the wrong time of day.
The wrong time of day? Why, whatever do you mean, Uncle?
Come and you'll see. There. What do you think of that?
Why, a gigantic coffee mill. I've seen the like of this in London.
Aye, but not put to this purpose, I warrant. This is our crushing engine, John. Put in a better load of smolder, Carfax, and let them work the crank for John to understand a thing or two.
In the daytime? Have the watch in there's been a leak.
Oh, one turn will do no harm. Come, Mads, pour some of that broken rock into the scuttle.
Master Huckleback, all this seems to me a dangerous and unholy enterprise just to get some few bits of metal out of the ground.
Aye, it is, lad, it is. And up to now, my two partners and me have put more gold into the ground than we've got out of it. But we must in a very short time succeed, and then it'll pay us back a hundredfold.
Turn the wheel, lad.
Aye, aye, Byron.
You understand the strange noises which keep people afear of these parts and let us work in peace.
I do, and have near lost my eardrums into the bargain. Now, Uncle, in return for cracking your bowler for you, I would like a private word with your master Carfax, for I believe he and I have something to discuss.
Oh, very well, but don't keep him talking all day. There's work to be done.
Carfax, come here a minute.
Carfax? I fear you're a shallow fellow and not worth my trouble.
Then don't take it. I want no man's trouble.
For your sake, I would not. But for your daughter's sake, I will. The daughter you left to starve by the wayside.
Left to starve? No child of man was ever left to starve.
Did you bring up from Cornwall a little girl called Gwenny, and supposed to be your daughter?
Aye. And she were my daughter. And for her, I would give this mine and all the gold will ever come from it.
You may ever without that. If you only prove to me that you did not abandon her.
They told me she were dead, crushed and buried in the drift here. The almighty blast their man in work if the devil's lied to me.
But I know from one who'd never lie that Gwenny was found alone by the road and would have died if that good young woman had not taken pity on her.
You mean that my Gwenny's alive? Where? Where?
Tell me first your story.
They brought me up from Cornwall, see, with stores and much money to be foreman here. And when they found I had Gwenny with me, well, they thought I had best to get rid of her.
Well, why should they do that?
Because they wanted it all secret. And so they didn't want workers with children running about talking. Single men only they wanted. Well, I had left Gwenny by the road, but only while I went to see about getting some good woman to look after her. Then they got me drunk. Kept me drunk for 3 all days. And when I was sober, they told me she'd wandered to the mine, fallen in, been killed. And for all they knew or cared, she might have. Why, but where's she now? When can I see her?
She's staying with us at Plover's Barrows Farm. And you may see her as soon as you wish.
This evening, then. After dark. Oh, and the Lord help you, John Red, big as you are, if you lie to me over this.
And so it was that Simon Carfax and Gwenny were brought together again. Not long after, Annie and Tom Faggus were married, without the benefit of Uncle Reuben's presence, though he sent them a fine bale of cloth by way of recompense. And Mother was so moved as to weep a milk pan full of tears, just to show her particular pleasure. And so, for a short time, peace fell upon our home, and I wished it might ever continue so, for any man can have too much of adventure and alarms. We had pushed to the back of our minds the paper left by the man from the Court of Chancery, preferring, as with all unpleasant things, not to think about it. But Chancery would not be pushed back when it had a mind to come forward. That day I'd been working in a far part of the farm, taking my midday dinner in a linen cloth, and not coming home till evening. Lizzie was waiting for me at the gate, and I could have wished it had been dear Annie to break such news.
John, you must know it before long, and Mother is prostrate with grief.
Lizzie, this is no time for your fine phrases. Something's happened. I see it in your face. Is it Lorna? Tell me!
Gone to London. And Gwenny with her.
You little vixen. This is your doing. 'Tis your spite has sickened her. I could forget you're my sister.
Don't you raise your hand to me, John Ridd. Remember, Sergeant Bloxham's here. He will stop you venting your nasty temper upon me, as you used to do.
You and Sergeant Bloxham both will feel the heat of my temper unless you explain this thing.
Then stop shouting, John. And listen. Two men, two grand men from London, came this morning just after 10 o'clock. They were from the High Court of Chancery. They had papers to prove it. I read them myself.
And with pleasure, I'll warrant. Yes, and then?
Why? Then she packed and went. It did not take long.
But couldn't she have waited?
She had no choice. It may please your vanity to know she begged them to wait. But since we could not tell them when you might return, they thought they'd better set out.
But did she leave no word where I might find her? Who's taking care of her?
Oh, it seems she has an uncle in London. Some grand lord. And he is now her guardian and master. The men said she must live with him until she's 21 years of age.
But that's 3 years or more. Not to see her for 3 years. Oh, Lizzie. But wait. She will write. When she arrives and is settled, she will write. And tell me where I may send word.
I fear you're very innocent, Brother John. She has gone to London. And when she sees the brave young men there, and when they see her, I doubt you will set eyes upon your Lorna again.
That was part 4 of Lorna Doone, dramatized for radio by Brian Gear from the novel by R.D. Blackmore, with Jack Watson as the storyteller, Cornelius Garrett as John Ridd, and Stacey Dorning as Lorna Doone. Others in the cast were Councillor Doone and Reuben Huckaback, Richard Grant, Tom Faggus, Alan Moore, Jeremy Stickles and Simon Carfax, Rex Holdsworth, Benita, Elizabeth Bell, Mrs. Ridd, June Barry, Annie Ridd, Petra Lear, Carver Doone, Brian Jackson, Lizzie Ridd, Paula Tinker, Sergeant Bloxham, Hubert Tucker, and Tim, Ann Porters. The program, which came from Bristol, was directed by Brian Miller.